A heads up to our more profanity scrupulous listeners. This episode's first guest guilelessly and eloquently uses some crass words that I'm sure you've heard before, but may not like to hear or share. So maybe, I don't know, give it a listen before you play the podcast over the church bus PA on the youth group trip to Six Flags. I'm Chris White, and this is the Electric Jesus Podcast. Let me set the scene for you. Your first relationship. You and your beloved, both devout Christian teenagers, are starting to feel all the feels. Talk turns to the future.
Let me revise the plan. You'll go to school here at Belmont, major in music.
Yes.
And I'll get one of those jobs at a recording studio on Music Row.
No college?
I'll get in good with music biz people. Open doors for you.
Perfect.
I like it. Like Amy Grant and Gary Chapman. Yeah. You know, I read in Lady's Home Journal that she would never want to compare Gary's moans to another man's. I'm serious. She talks about them like having sex and stuff and drinking wine and walking around on nude beaches.
That doesn't sound right.
I have the magazine. It's in there.
And just like that, the prospect of sex has entered the discussion.
It's just like when you were talking about us in Nashville. Just kind of made me think, you know?
Welcome to season two of the Electric Jesus Podcast. I'm your host, Chris White, writer, director, and producer of the 2021 rock and roll comedy, Electric Jesus. Last season, we went behind the scenes to discover the music that inspired the world of Electric Jesus and the amazing work our team did to create an all-new soundtrack for the film. This season, I've selected 9 key scenes from the film to talk about with fellow artists, authors, academics, pastors, old friends, and new. There will be spoilers. So if you've not yet seen the film, I encourage you to watch it. It's streaming all over the place. Just Google it. Or better, click the link to our streaming partners in the show notes. And if you have seen the film, well, I mean, I'm guessing that since you're listening to this, the film connected with you in some way. I'm glad. And I hope that these conversations add to your enjoyment and appreciation of Electric Jesus.
Episode 3, Christian Teens and Sex.
Nadia Bolz Weber is an ordained Lutheran pastor, founder of House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, Colorado, and host of The Confessional. This is a podcast where guests share stories about when they were at their absolute worst. Essentially, what happened, why, and what, if anything, they learned from it. It is a great podcast to listen to if you're OD'd on social media. It's kind of a remedy for that. She is the author of 3 New York Times best-selling memoirs, Pastrix, Accidental Saints, and most recently, Shameless, A Sexual Reformation. The first thing about Shameless, I would say, is you write so beautifully. Translucently is the word I'm looking with so many pitch perfect details. The book would have impact without that richness, but it does have that level of artfulness. That's one of the reasons I was so taken with the book, because it just didn't have to be written that well to make some of the points you were trying to make. There's certainly things about the book that create, the polite word is conversations, I guess controversy, but you're so measured through it. I mean, you make your points forcefully, but you seem to allow for those who would disagree or have different life experience. You allow them their cultural anxiety. Like you don't run them out of the room.
I would have written that book very differently in my 30s. So I think I would have alienated anybody who didn't agree exactly with everything I was saying.
What changed? What changed though?
I'm just older. It's just, hopefully we grow in wisdom. I mean, despite ourselves, right? I mean, one would hope that the longer you're alive, the more you sort of soften around some of the sharper edges of your personality and your hangups and stuff. And that's been the case for me.
You even go so far in the book as to take yourself to task for not finding grace for fellow Christians who have put forward very hurtful ideas. I mean, I would not imagine that those people would extend the same grace to you.
Yeah, but they, you know, they don't have to live with themselves. You know what I mean? In the same way. Like, I try to remain sufficiently suspicious of myself at all times. Uh-huh. And I think part of it is just I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 31 years. You know, we're sort of trained to really look at, where were we at fault? Where are our shortcomings? And not in a low self-esteem way at all.
Right, right.
And it's sort of, hey, man, I got to keep my side of the street clean or I'm going to drink. You're kind of trained to do that work. And I kind of wish more people were trained to do that work, honestly. You know, I mean, to kind of have a clear assessment of ourselves and our shortcomings and when we're maybe being selfish or when we're maybe being a little arrogant or, you know, where we're sort of assuming we know somebody else's heart when we don't, you know, all that stuff.
Well, we live in such a graceless time. Everybody's like, I mean, it's piety, especially public piety is a dangerous drug, man. It feels good to be publicly pious and to be right. And it becomes very difficult to have, it's very difficult to just kind of mea culpa, because as soon as you do, then people destroy it. Well, like in your podcast, I mean, one of the beautiful things about that is you're creating safety. I mean, the intimacy of that conversation is safe. I don't know if, you know, people have to come to a level where, okay, I'm willing for this to be a public thing.
The reason I only did 3 seasons is it was extraordinarily difficult to book that podcast.
See, that alone is
because I even did a cattle call. It was so frustrating. I cannot tell you. It was the most difficult, most frustrating part of that podcast was finding the right guests for it. And I even, out of desperation, went on social media. I was like, oh, are you a fan of the podcast? Do you have a story? You know, would you be a good guest? And honest to God, Chris, I got like 30 self-pitying emails. Like, I got 30 emails about what other people had done to them or how they, you know, and I'm like, those stories are so readily available to us. Like, our recall of other people being assholes to us is so clear and immediate. And yet, you know, a lot of us have nearly no recall of us ever being shitty, hurting someone else, being an asshole to someone else. And I'm like, you know, just globally, like, the math doesn't fucking work, right? I mean, are there just, what, half a dozen assholes who are hurting everybody and everyone else are blameless victims? You know, there's no chance of that being true.
Right.
And yet, you know, we're at this moment where, like, grievance is king and pointing the fingers at how other people have caused harm, you know, is very, you get a dopamine hit from that, mm-hmm, you know, it's mm-hmm. very, there's the self-satisfaction to it, but just developmentally, it's so limited. All of us should have maybe aged out of, you know, by the time we're 35, you know, and yet culturally, all of that vibe, those voices are so loud and they're so favored in the algorithms on social media.
Oh yeah.
It's made me sort of opt out largely. I've largely opted out. Somebody asked me in a Q&A maybe a year ago, year and a half, hey, what are your hopes for the future? And I was like, well, first of all, I hope I can get through a yoga class without getting angry. That would be like number one. But number two would be, I hope for my view, how I view myself and other people and the world itself, to be more affected and informed by my life than the shit I read online. I think so much of this is really related to a very human need, which is a need to belong, a need to feel safe, and a need to feel good. And so our need to feel like we're good people, you know, is can really not serve us sometimes. I'm in much more danger of doing harm to myself and other people when I'm blindly convinced of my virtue,
yeah,
than I ever am when I'm definitely acting out of my vices. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, police stations have vice squads. They should fucking have virtue squads. Honest to God, really. Where's the virtue squad? Police station. Because my mom, my sweet mama says, once you're convinced you're right about something, you stop taking in new information, which I love, you know? Okay, so in 1986, I pretty much had exited the church at that point. So okay. It was right when I was leaving. So I was still in high school. That was my, I graduated in the spring of 87. So I was a junior in high school. And that's when everything really started unraveling. So I had already been drinking and doing drugs for quite a while at that point. Definitely having sex with my boyfriend. You know, it's funny because, you know, you're taught how dangerous sex is and how it's like, you know, you should really actually fucking fear it as much as possible.
Yeah.
Until you're married, and then a little switch flips off in your head, and then suddenly it's the most beautiful, natural, wonderful thing in the world, right?
Yeah.
And you're so glad you didn't experience anything related to it until that time. You know, like, this is what we're
right.
Taught. And you know, when I was interviewing people, I interviewed people for a year and a half for Shameless, and asking them, like, what message did you receive about sex and the body and gender and desire from the church? How did that message affect you? And then how have you navigated your adult life since then? You know, a lot of people had a really difficult time connecting to their own sexuality, like to their own natural sexual response system. That just wasn't, thank God, that was not my experience. So when I started having sex with my boyfriend in 1986, he was older. He was a few years older and sort of shockingly experienced for a 20-year-old. and not Christian. So he had no shame about sex at all. He mm-hmm. loved sex. And he loved women. He loved women's bodies. And he was a really excellent lover. So when I started having sex, I loved it. I was like, fuck, this is for me, man. I love it. And so I had this completely different experience, but it almost hastened my departure from Christianity, because I'm like, I don't know what you people are talking about. Like, this wow. is fun.
Well, what kind of church was that for you when you were?
Dude, I was raised in the Church of Christ.
Okay.
We weren't allowed, I mean, growing up when I was in middle school, like, we weren't allowed to wear shorts in public. Church of Christ kids aren't allowed to dance. You know, I mean,
do you have really music or no instruments? Is there something like that with Church of Christ?
Yeah.
Okay.
No instruments, no musical instruments. Women can't pray out loud in front of men. We were the only Christians. We were the only people going to heaven. So it's very sectarian, especially when I was younger. As I got older, when we moved to the Denver area, it wasn't quite as conservative. But interestingly, where the most heavily ideological, like, conservative Christian shit came up was summer camps, retreats, mission trips. Like, that was where it was so heavy-handed.
Right.
Not so much at church youth group. It was a little mellower there.
Yeah.
But when we were on those things, I definitely asked if my boyfriend could come to the retreat, and then we had, you know, sex in the loft of the church choir area in the chapel.
When you think about all that Christian culture and stuff, and you look back to when you were just kind of saying, enough of this, I'm leaving this. What were the most insidious ideas about sex and gender and relationships that church was putting, evangelical, mainline, or otherwise?
I think it's that idea that God's plan for humanity, that there is a description that they will give to you of what it looks like to be in God's favor, right?
Right.
And it is if you are heterosexual and cisgendered, and also that you never look at pornography, and you don't have sex before marriage, and you marry another Christian, and then you have nice Christian babies, and you never sleep with anyone else, and you don't, like, do you know what I mean? It's like that monogamous, all this stuff. So that is just drilled into you over and over and over again. But when I got out into the world and saw how mind-blowingly beautifully diverse it was, I was like, oh my God, that's not a description of a righteous person. That's just a description of some people. There are some people who legitimately, that's who they are. They're wired like that. It's natural for them. They really couldn't be anything else. That's who they are. And so to me, the idea of describing one type of person and then saying the creator of the universe is only pleased with this type of person, if that's God's plan, God planned poorly because there are so many different kinds of people. So that was the thing that got to me. When I was growing up in the Church of Christ, I was taught that all the rules, or what Lutherans call the law, or even just the Ten Commandments, right? The Ten Commandments and all the rules in the Bible and a bunch of them that the church just fucking made up, those are there because God loves you and wants you to be happy. And God knows, God has a plan for your life. God has a way that human beings are supposed to live. And if we follow all these guidelines, we'll be happy. And then I get to Lutheran seminary. They're like, bullshit. The Ten Commandments are about the fact that God loves your neighbor and wants to protect them from you. Right? This is why. So it's called having this kind of low anthropology, saying like, given the chance, we will be selfish. Now, we'll also surprisingly be fucking glorious and transcendent and beautiful to each other, right? Mm-hmm. We have both of these capacities. But the law, the second use of the law is to go, okay, well, if here are all the guidelines for you to be righteous and to be perfect or pious or honestly woke or whatever the fuck, or wellness has a lot of legalism in it too, right? Mm-hmm. So here are the standards you have to meet, and they are impossible to fulfill. And I'm like, if that's all you have, if all you have are here are all the standards you have to meet in order to be woke or in order to be well or in order to be righteous or a good disciple or whatever, if that's the system you're under and that's all that's fucking offered, you have two choices, really. Pride or despair. So either you're so proud of the fact that you're nailing it and other people aren't, which we see a lot on Twitter, or you despair in the fact that no matter what you do, it's never enough, right? Neither of those are paths to freedom or flourishing.
Right.
What Lutheran theology says is, yeah, man, the law will crush you. If that's all you have. But the amazing thing is there is this unbelievable force in the world that comes from the heart of God, which is grace. And there's a freedom to the fact that, nobody's going to be able to do this perfectly. And it's okay because grace comes in and goes, oh, and there's something really transcendent and beautiful and holy. And every time the law kills you, grace can bring you back to life and go, I am forgiven, that there are second chances, that I can have compassion for myself. It allows for compassion for myself and other people in a way that legalism never does.
Yeah. What was it about Lutheranism, or maybe even Martin Luther in particular, or that tradition that made you feel comfortable there?
It really had to do with the fact that I'd already spent so much time in the basement of churches in AA meetings, that it kind of allowed me to be curious about what was happening upstairs in the church. So in terms of Lutheran specifically, it was just this crazy experience of kind of stumbling into this beautiful articulation of what I'd already experienced to be true. Mm. Like in AA, we say that God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. There's this sort of intact or this sort of innate humility, I think, to 12-step recovery, because basically it's like this unbelievably successful organization in America where in order to belong, you have to be a failure, you know, which is so anti-American, yeah. You know. This idea that like God does for us what we can't do for ourselves, just this focus on grace. It was the only theological system where the point of the center of gravity isn't discipleship. It's not piety. It's not activism. It's grace. That's the that is the point of gravity. And that's why I was attracted to it. And that's why I've been sort of obsessed with it ever since. And I do have a definition, a sort of for grace that I have right now, where I say grace is like it's the freight train that delivers into my life all of the most beautiful and unearnable things, like forgiveness and second chances and the fact that, you know, and holding a baby, you can't earn that, you know, like pizza, yeah, eating a perfect peach in summer. How much virtue do you have to earn the right to eat a perfect fucking peach in the middle of summer, right? That's right. Just grace. And yeah. So that most of my life is filled with beautiful things that are entirely unearnable. It's the thing that I have been obsessed with. If the supernatural seems a little out there, maybe there's a thing or two somebody ought to say to you. The same God who spared an instant listening to my cries, opening my disembodied eyes, yonder where the spirit never dies, said to paddle in him, son, too far out, don't get too far out. People are religious and every place and time and culture. I mean, there are needs within the human being that religion meets, and religion fashions itself in endless variety. And so it's a sort of recent thing that you can leave your original symbol system.
Yeah.
You know? And so I found it to integrate back into it in a different tradition. I don't know, for me, it's been really healing. And I have less anger about my upbringing than I used to. I used to be really angry about it. And now I can actually, I've told this story a few times, but one of my parishioners, when I was at House for All Sinners and Saints, she had just come out of the Church of Christ and she was still in that really angry, activated place, which I understand fully. But she would get so angry at shit she'd see her friends from her upbringing post on Facebook, like stupid Christian memes and stuff. She'd get angry.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, Nadia, you don't seem angry anymore. And I go, yeah, I really am not. And she goes, when did you know you were free from it? You know? And I said, well, you know, that type of thinking, that dualistic thinking that they hand you, it's really hard to escape it. Like, you can take the girl out of fundamentalism, but you can't take the fundamentalism out of the girl, you know? So I ended up stepping right into leftist politics to where it was very intense. I got arrested, thrown in jail. I went to Cuba in 1989 when you were not supposed to go to Cuba. I was involved in some like armed land rights battle in northern New Mexico. It was very similar, right? It was very similar in the sense of here's how you know you're good. Here's the people who are bad. It's very dualistic, right? Well, I felt free from the anger and bitterness and stuff about my fundamentalist upbringing. The moment I was able to look back on that upbringing and not view it dualistically, as soon as I was able to see that there were beautiful things that were part of my upbringing, and doing so didn't feel like a betrayal of the parts of me that the shitty part of my upbringing hurt, that's when I was free. You know?
Yeah. And that is a reconstruction of faith, but But it goes through certainly a deconstruction. You have to clear the decks somehow. You have to.
Absolutely.
And only that person that, only the fundamentalist girl can realize that, oh, I'm doing it again. That epiphany has to come to you and say, why do I, the dualism, there it is again.
Right. And so that heavily ideological stuff you see on social media, I can't play. Like, I played for a while and then I was like, this feels familiar to me in an uncomfortable way, because part of me loves dualism. It like fucking chocolate, you know? I mean, I eat it up. It is where I feel at home, you know, it's this really like knowing who's good, who's bad, who's right, who's wrong, being able to call it, being able to see it in other people, calling people out, you know, all of this shit, outrage, all that. When I start recognizing it as that, I have to step back. It's not good for me, you know?
Thinking about young you again. Oh man, right at that moment when you're kind of breaking away. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I have some insight into that girl, because I've read Shameless, and again, I see her. So when you think about her, what grace do you give her? Like being mom to yourself, my science fiction scenario, what are you proud of her for? What do you want to say? You just take her into your arms and love on her and...
You ask great questions. I love that. I feel like I've only really in the past several years had the capacity to look back on her with real compassion, real compassion, and to go, we are these kind of nesting dolls, you know, in a sense, in that she's still a part of me. I guess the thing I would be so proud of her about is that she had a sense of self that was almost defiant to what she was raised to believe about herself, you know? Mm-hmm. And I do. I have so much compassion for her. And also at the same time, seeing how much she still has to learn. You know?
That's the tough thing. And I'm a parent as well. And that's the thing that my kids are in their 20s now, but it's the thing that's so hard, that balance between, oh man, I want to be an ally. I want to be your buddy. I want to be here. I want us to have a cool life. There's so many years that you aren't my little kid.
Yeah.
And then you just see them just careening into just stupidity or foolishness. And like, how do you manage that? And maybe that is how we should manage and love ourselves, because I'm doing that too. I'm steering into stupidity all the time.
Dude, I think when I'm 80 and I look back on me, I'm 54 now. Uh-huh. And when I'm 80 and I think of my 54-year-old self, like, I hope that my 80-year-old self has compassion.
Yeah.
But probably my 80-year-old self will look at me and go, oh, honey, you had so much more to learn.
Yeah.
You have no idea all the things you're going to learn between now, you know, then and now. I think it's important, you know, there's this meditation teacher, Jeff Warren. He had this meditation in which he talks about when he gets super kind of activated and a little spun out, he puts his hand on his heart and he goes, it's okay, little brother. Like, he calls himself little brother. Mm-hmm. And I cried when I heard him say this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's getting a little dusty myself hearing that.
I know. Because like, to think of that, like to show myself the kindness and compassion I would towards a little sister of mine, you know, who's kind of hurt or scared or a little freaked out, you know, and that's different than what I call affirmation porn, which is very readily available on Instagram. You know, a lot of influencers have sort of built their brand on affirmation porn. I feel like saying, like, it's okay, little sister, is very different, because I feel like what's underneath it is the subtext is, of course you're scared, and of course you're a little bit shaky, and you're going to make a million bad decisions. It's this actual compassion. So that's not self-care to me. That's just going, oh, that feels like the advanced course in compassion is to have it, truly have it for yourself, you know?
I think maybe that's the thing that people respond to in the movie, especially if they came out of the world, is just that I just didn't judge the characters. I just let them say the stupid things they said. And so, you know, I have to sit through the movie and cringe a lot of times, but I like that little Christian teenagers are serious about something. I like that little me would listen to U2 songs and memorize the words and figure out, you know, what Bono, the cool Christian from Ireland, was telling me, you know, like.
Yeah, totally. I did the same myself. Totally. I think it's, I guess they call it deconstruction now, but, you know, I was going through that process when there wasn't the internet or a community or a term for it or books.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have Rachel Held Evans books. You know?
Right, right.
When I was leaving the church, and when that's all you know, that's all you know growing up, it's such an alienating process to leave it. I found it to feel this odd kind of alienate, which is why, like, coming back to Christianity, but in a way that made sense to me, that had integrity, that made, you know, that I didn't have to check my brain at the door. I didn't have to check part of my story at the door. Mm-hmm. Coming back to my original symbol system that I had to leave for reasons of self-preservation for a decade, right?
Yeah.
It was 10 times more liberating than leaving it to begin with.
Anderson is an author, a speaker, I think it's fair to say a Bible teacher. She lives in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia with her husband, Nathan, and three children. She has a lot of books, Hannah, that are worth recommending, but for me, very much just following you. This is so how shallow I am. I like following you on Instagram because they're just excerpts and stuff from your writing, but that's a good way to interact with your writing. You have a podcast, or you co-host a podcast? Is that on hold?
Yes.
Okay.
That's on extended hiatus, okay. But there's lots of back episodes.
Yeah. And I've heard it, and it's really good because this is like talking about culture, theology, and just, you know, just day-to-day stuff, but from a Christian perspective.
A lot of what I'm doing is asking questions about what a flourishing life looks like from the teachings of Christ, and not just in a very narrow sense of our soul's salvation, but like the salvation and the flourishing of our whole lives. So a lot of those questions come forward in culture and, you know, how we're living out day to day. And so that's where a lot of the conversations I'm interested in originate.
Well, I'm so glad that you found time to talk to me about Electric Jesus, especially this, it's cringy scene. What kind of church background did you come up in when you were a teenager?
I was in a pretty conservative background, probably more properly labeled kind of fundamentalist, but it was heavily influenced by broader evangelical culture.
Okay.
We like to think of ourselves as not evangelicals, but I don't think there's any escaping the kind of gravity of larger evangelical culture. So a lot of the influences on me were kind of coming from spaces I didn't even really have direct connection to, but the whole moment, right?
Yeah.
So coming up in the 80s and the 90s in a fairly conservative background, it was all informed by that larger cultural moment too. You know, when I was young, it was Reagan and, you know, whole milieu. And so I don't think there was anything that was untouched by that.
And I think it's also fair to point out for people who are not familiar at all with that world, or maybe see it as a strange outlier, that at the time, evangelical had a theological meaning. You know, it wasn't just, I think now it just means what? It means Republican politics or something. Right. I think it's basically turned into an unhelpful term, at least for me. Mm-hmm. But at the time, evangelical meant, among other things, that we believe the Bible was a literal, you know, word of God. That was important. If it was in the Bible, that's what God said, and that's what God meant. And then also the idea of sharing your faith with other people, that faith could be assented to, and we would want to encourage people to accept Christ.
And I would add to it, maybe to this to the point of this conversation too, it was deeply committed. All of your life was bound up in faith and religious practice. And so whatever your relationship to God was, it permeated every decision you made. So there was this holistic faith. It wasn't like just something we did on Sundays.
If you weren't engaged in some kind of Christian thought or action in some aspect of your life, that was seen as a problem.
And that's what I remember a lot, is the intensity at a young age. I mean, teenagers especially are already a little... There's a lot of energy there. But I remember this just complete call to give every part of yourself to God, and then defining what that would look like. And so there was a lot of emphasis on committed, being surrendered, being on fire for God.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a whole lot of downtime. Like,
no,
off. So I think that informs some of what this scene is doing too.
And in my particular brand of evangelical Christianity, it was okay to listen to Christian rock music, and even some secular rock music was maybe okay, but you really had to, it was about the lyrics. You had to run the lyrics through a filter, but Christian rock music was a part of that kind of devotion. I mean, I had a friend who told me one time, instead of tithing, he bought Christian music. That was like his tithe, which I love that idea. My parents wouldn't, I don't think I was allowed to tithe at the Christian bookstore buying music, but that idea of this is an act of faith, like, you know, it's part of my faith is acted out. And so, yeah, riding around your car, listening to whoever, Stryper or Amy Grant, whoever, was a big thing. And which is why in this scene that I remember something almost verbatim to this happening. To me, when I was a teenager, I think Sarah has it's Ladies Home Journal that's got an article where Amy Grant is just talking about her marriage in maybe a way that Amy Grant is not maybe regretted and wanted to have those words back. But, you know, there was a discussion about an open, frank discussion about a Christian married couple and their behavior that is presented maybe as a flirt.
So I came from a background that was conservative, but I don't think broader purity culture had completely permeated where we were, because I grew up in the country. So it was also informed a little bit by, you shouldn't be doing these things, but also. So there was this kind of this natural, this is the way things are within the local kind of church, where it was, we should not be doing these things. You know, there should not be physical contact. You should save yourself for marriage. At 18, I went off to college. I think I hit more profound kind of explicit purity culture and lines and kind of a sense of seriousness about dating. But for me, that was a move more toward suburban spaces. And I don't know if that's relevant to this discussion so much as there seemed, in my experience of it, that the culture was carried along a little bit by consumption. You could buy into the culture a little bit more if you could get the purity ring, or you could go to the conference where people were teaching about sexuality for teenagers. And when you're off in a little country church, the way I grew up, you just don't have access to that culture. You can't buy into it as much while you're still getting kind of the waves of it. Because it's coming over like radio stations. It's, you know, it's focused on the family that's being piped into the car, even though you're not maybe enmeshed in it the way some folks might be. So for me growing up, I don't remember a negative messaging around married sex, but there was clearly don't trust yourself before then, right? You need to, you know, be very cautious and careful. And then once you're married, you know, here's all of this abundance.
Right.
I also remember it being somewhat gendered, you know, for sure. Well, so clearly modesty was wrapped up in that. So like how you would relate to your own body and modesty in the spaces I was in, that was even more of a question, but it was more about resisting culture than it was maybe physicality. So it was about resisting trends, resisting fashion as being caught up in the world, you know, but modesty was an important thing for girls, particularly as there was a message of be modest so you don't tempt your brothers to sin. You know, you don't want them to think lustful thoughts about you. And yet it was very mixed messages, I think. That's what I came away with, even now as an adult looking back, was being very confused by this powerful thing called sex that was really, really good at one place in time, but also really not to be trusted in any way, in any form at all before then, in the sense of, you know, it did have a sense of some shame, but just distrust, just massive distrust of yourself. But I think that distrust of self was broader than just sex and dating. It was, you couldn't trust that you were making the right decision about anything. How do you know that when you pick this career that you're actually doing God's will? So there was a distrust of self that I think was underneath all of it. And when it came to dating or sex, that just doubled.
That idea of my own personal discernment of what's right and wrong for just practically, but also in relation to sin and my understanding of God. If I have a feeling or an emotion that is very, very wary about that. So, I mean, when you get into dating and relationships, well, I feel like I love this or am attracted or, you know, I feel this red flags everywhere. You know, I'm in a play at high school and I really love it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's good though.
This more than I love God?
Yeah.
Has this become an idol to me because I feel these things toward, and so the emotional life, I remember a great deal of distrust. And to your point, romance and attraction and affection are really deeply seated in emotional life and desire. If you don't have a healthy relationship to that across the board, when it comes to dating and sex, it's just a perfect storm.
Think back to the teenage and maybe early 20s you. What kind of things does the wise older you want to counsel the younger you? What things would you have wanted to bring across to young you?
I think I probably would have wanted a younger me to receive my desires more from God than to doubt them. And that would include, like, what do you want to do with yourself? What do you like? What do you enjoy? Kind of an exploration more around the question of how has God put you together with your interests and your desires and receiving those things, and less concerned about puzzling out rationally what is this thing that God's doing in your life. Mm-hmm. And trusting a little bit more that, you know, you're a good kid. You're trying to do your best and you can follow those things, trusting that God's not going to let you be lost in them. Like you're not going to get so far down a path that God's not going to be present with you there. So I think just probably instilling at a younger age, the trust and maybe a distinction between trusting yourself as God has put you together and learning then to distrust when you are being harmful or selfish, learning the distinction between desire and selfishness. And I think in my experience, they were just so conflated. Mm-hmm. And particularly when it comes to relationships, then all of that is very difficult. And I could see it in the scene. Like I could see the conflict in the character, mm-hmm. particularly of longing for something, but not knowing if he could have it, if it was okay,
yeah.
or what to do.
He says that doesn't sound right. Yes. So many things don't sound right, you know, and but that really is something important to him. This is not working. I love how Andy plays this scene too. He's really lost in it. There's a term, sin management, which was so mm-hmm. much of, I remember that as being a big part of my youth group experience. Like, how can we not sin?
And like a hypervigilance, right? Yeah. Which is, this just sets you up for anxiety and lifelong looking over your shoulder. Uh-huh. But a sense of that sin was lurking everywhere.
Yeah.
And it could jump you.
Yeah.
And so you always had to be on guard. And not only was it out there around you in the world, but it was inside of you. It was your motives, right? So there was a lot of policing of motives. Am I doing this for the right reason?
Right.
Am I just trying to get something out of this?
Yeah, and so
when people hear purity culture, maybe language, you know, we often mean purity of the body, right? Or a virginal or a virginity. But I think it was more than that. It was trying to attain a purity of intention and motivation and personhood that just, I don't even think is possible or is real. So it was an attempt to purify the self of any form of sin or any form of mixed motivation that could possibly happen to reduce the person to this essential good.
And what you're talking, I remember that. I felt so weighed down by all that. I don't think I ever really even heard the gospel presented until I was an adult in a way that didn't feel like I had, there was more for me to do. I mean,
right. You had to earn it. So like,
presented.
Here you are. Jesus died for you. Now you better do a good job.
Yeah.
Not to mess up.
Yeah. As soon as you like hear this good news, the gospel is good news. And
from
you're
here
like,
on out.
This is so good. And then they're
now responsible for everything.
So how do we, as Christians, how do you talk to like a Christian? How do we create a Christian teenage culture or a thinking and attitudes about sex that is both practical and spiritual and graceful and all the things it should be? I've not seen it. I've not heard it enunciated. I don't know how to do it. What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of the dilemmas we have around communicating sex and a really holistic sexual ethic have nothing to do with sex. And they have more to do with how we understand bodies, how we understand creation, how we understand relationships and community. As I've heard the rhetoric emerge, out of conservative or evangelical spaces, it's far too modern to make sense, right? So it's not the way the Bible, when I say the Bible, right? It's not the way you hear scripture speaking about our bodies or about relationships. And one of the things that struck me, because I grew up right in a very conservative space, but it also taught me to read my Bible. So that was, you got your time to read. So I read my Bible a lot and I read it cover to cover. And I remember reading Old Testament scriptures, kind of Hebraic understanding. And I was struck by this disconnect where premarital sex was treated radically different than adultery, right? Mm. But in our context, premarital sex was the greater evil and adultery was like, that kind of happens. Well, you should forgive and just move on. Yeah. Or if you have to get divorced. So like, I noticed this disconnect where the scriptures like with premarital sex, especially in the Old Testament, it's like, yeah, so that happens. Now you got to get married. Like, or you got to pay the bride. Or you, yeah, don't do that. And also take responsibility for that. Like, you can't just go around. You have to take responsibility for your body and your actions. Whereas, like, when someone broke covenant, it was massive. It was like capital crime.
Yeah.
And so that was the first thing that kind of clued me into the fact that we're not actually tracking here, because we were putting the accent and the emphasis on a completely different place, which was this virginal kind of.
Yeah. But for women, I think it was creating a, I just see it as we wanted girls to be pure, quote unquote, yes, perfect, blameless, spotless perfections. Mm-hmm. I think there was a lot more space for boys to.
There was.
Yeah.
And I didn't figure that out until later. And I did, I was really frustrated. And that was
the
entire part of watching this scene, because I remember girls were, not only were they to be pure, right, and to be modest, but they also were to be alluring enough to catch a guy's attention. Mm-hmm. And so the subtlety of the flirtation is exactly what a girl was led to do, was you have to at least try to get their attention, and you can subtly suggest things. And what was fascinating about that kind of gender dynamic is women were told to be very, very conscious of male sexuality, because it's just like this raging beast.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not even responsible. Like, they're going to mess up because they're just like this raging mass of
hormones. They're feral almost.
Like. Right. Right. And so as a girl, you have to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. You have to both protect yourself and protect them from themselves. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of responsibility about the purity of the relationship being placed on the girl, right? But at the same time, she had to be alluring, you know, to a degree. Mm-hmm. So there was this balance between don't ever cross the line, but make sure you get up to the line.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, you don't want to not get married someday. I mean,
right. Yeah. Right. You've got to send the signals out. You've got to be attractive, but not so attractive that he'll sleep with you. Right.
Bible scholar teacher hat, and I want you to talk to me about Ruth and Boaz. I mean, when you were talking about the premarital thing, and I know the story. I mean, her mother-in-law, it's her mother-in-law is telling her, "I need you to, you need to go to where this guy, you need to go to his bed, and just hang out there, and he'll pick up on the fact that
you're available."
Yeah. And
the whole story of Ruth, it is one in which a world where a woman's relationship state had massive bearing on her ability to stay alive, you know, to survive and not starve to death. And so, you know, some of that is the understanding the role, how marriage and how coupling and how relationships even occurred in the cultural context. I think the Bible is a lot earthier than we are. Like, we are so uncomfortable with the way it presents the facts of reality. And that's not like a condemnation or condoning. It's just like, this is the way people are. And then within that, you have to build out an ethic. So the ethic has to be built out of what do we know about people? What do we know about community? What do we know about this moment in time? What do we know about the principles of our bodies and loving our neighbors well, loving God well, and relating to all the gifts and the potential and the vocation of our bodies? And so for me, you had asked earlier, how do we develop a sexual ethic for teenagers? I think it's about vocation, not just like marriage, but like, what are you being called to? And how does this relationship further your love for God and further your love for your neighbor? How does this equip you to love God better and love other people better? And quite frankly, a lot of sexual experimentation doesn't do that. It doesn't get you down that road.
That's right.
Because it is about self. It's very self-referential. And that's not to say the self is wrong or our sexual appetites are wrong. It's just recognizing this larger call and this larger vocation and saying, is this carrying me along the path that God has for me? And that's less clear for teenagers, right? So like, we like to give them rules, like, don't do this, don't, this is too far, how far is too far? But I think if we're really going to develop a sexual ethic that stands the test of time, it has to be rooted in that larger sense of calling, being called to God and love for others through, you know, self-sacrifice. And that's going to set you up for a really good marriage, you know, really good sex later.
So what would you say to someone who carries a wound that was brought about by purity culture? I'm not trying to persuade them or pull them back into church necessarily, but how do you talk to people who carry one of these mm-hmm. church-inflicted, evangelical culture-inflicted wounds specifically towards sex and sexuality?
For me, and within my own process, it's, of course you do. Yes, yes. Of course you do. What you are experiencing and the wounds you feel is real and true. And based on what we all went through, of course this exists. And I think there has to be a recognition of that and an attending to it and a facing it and naming it. And I think there, among conservatives particularly, or just mainstream evangelicalism, there's a real fear to acknowledge the wounds. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, if we do that, then we're not going to be able to build out a sexual ethic that we feel is, I don't know, biblical or conservative enough or whatever. And I think we just have to say, no, this could be really, really harmful, and there be a sexual ethic that is consistent with Christian teaching. And this wasn't.
Yeah. I've always found in relationships of any kind to say, I'm sorry, I was totally wrong. I wish I hadn't done, you know, a real repentance apology really helps the relationship.
Yes. No. And I think there's also an acknowledgement that a lot of people carry harm and wounds that they're still not in safe places to acknowledge or to even recognize, because they're still in community, because none of this is individual, right? And that's what even the beautiful thing about talking about sexual ethics is, none of this is about one person. I mean, sex is by definition communal. And so it is entirely possible that some people are deeply, deeply wounded and don't even have the space to identify that, because they're still in communities and where if they would begin to voice or name anything, it's just impossible, because then everything else fragments along with that. So I think you're absolutely right that like grace and space with each other is the only way out of these conversations. Like, we can name, yeah, this is off. This was not a healthy teaching, and this is how it potentially changed your sense of self, and maybe you need to recover that. Mm-hmm. Another thing I've been really, really hopeful about lately is the plasticity of the brain, but also the soul. Right? So that these things happen to us, or things that were beyond our control, particularly in childhood and young adult years, when so much was chosen for us. And I'm middle-aged, and you know, you get to that point and you look back and you're like, wow, how much did I choose of that? And how much was chosen for me? Mm-hmm. But I'm taking a great deal of hope and saying, yeah, but look at everything that can happen now. And look how I can heal and look how I can become who I want to be. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I don't have to live my life now in opposition to that. I can actually grow past it and name it and put it to, you know, put mm-hmm. it to rest mm-hmm. And find some level of peace to be able to say, yeah, wouldn't repeat that. Not good. This is how it harmed me, but also I healed. Now I have a larger, more expansive understanding, not only of the world, but of myself. So I think there's a great deal of hope in the ability of the human soul to grow and heal and change. And I think sometimes maybe that's where it comes into the grace conversation, where that's the fruit of grace, right? Is the ability that there's still the possibility of growth and life after what may be, feel like a death.
Electric Jesus is available wherever you stream movies. Check the links in the show notes to find the award-winning film, the soundtrack, a merch table filled with cool EJ stuff, and links to our guests and their work. If you enjoy the podcast, please be sure to rate and subscribe to it on your preferred player, and check out all the amazing extras we curate on the Electric Jesus YouTube page. Thanks for listening.
Magazine. It's in there.